I'm Captain Kevin Smith, and this is Throttle Up, a radio show and podcast dedicated to the proposition that critical thinking, when employed, can dramatically improve performance in whatever we are doing, enable us to solve problems that others avoid, equip us to become thought leaders instead of followers, and provide us with the intellectual resources and moral courage to support and defend America and its Constitution. Our motto is clarify, reason, win. That is, clarify the actual, employ analytic reason, and achieve mission success. Our website, throttleupradio.com, that has all kinds of information. Also, our podcast is located there, as well as iTunes. And of course, we have a blog, so please visit our website. Our support staff, Evergroove Studios for audio engineering services. They are located in Evergreen, Colorado, and Reflections Printing for multimedia support, and they are located in St. George, Utah. Our book is Critical Thinking Essentials, Quick Reference Handbook. It is available from Amazon, Barnes & Noble, and other outlets. Our broadcast time on Red State Talk Radio, we are on the weekends, both Saturday and Sunday, on the main channel, that's at 7 p.m., and the Encore channel, that's at 6 p.m. Okay, welcome back. Throttle Up. And this is going to be a regular Throttle Up show. We will interrupt the special edition that we are in the midst of. We are doing a special edition on innovation. And, you know, we have talked about it before. Certainly, it's been a major theme of ours, because innovation and critical thinking go hand in glove. But it was, you know, I was thinking it was timely that we focused ourselves on this whole issue of innovation, not least of which is because of the pandemic and the emergence from it. What are the lessons that we can learn? What are the good lessons that we can learn going forward, and how we can make our forward progress productive? Okay, so anyway, you know, we're kind of excited about that series, and we want to get back to it. But unfortunately, this week we have some issues that we really need to address and get up to speed on, stay current with, try to understand what's going on from a socio-political standpoint, the rage and the riots and the Black Lives Matter movement, Antifa, and so forth and so on, violence in the streets and what have you, pathetic apologies across the board. And we need to make sense out of it. In some, well, I mean, I would say some meaningful, productive way. The trigger was of course a profound tragedy. It actually should have never happened. And I, you know, I was thinking about that. I think that, you know, that we kind of had something going on. I don't classify it or characterize it as any kind of systemic racism, from my particular perspective. And, you know, and I've been around a long time, I've seen lots and lots of protests. I remember as a young man and as a young naval officer, the Vietnam protests were in full swing, and I've seen lots and lots of them in my long life. But how should we think about it? How should we deal with it? How should we come together? And how should we make those necessary alterations and corrections and healing processes so that we can progress as a nation? And in a way that is uplifting, in a way that is productive, in a way that supports all conscientious people. So that's where we are. Now we've got some stuff that I want to read. The first order of business is to revisit the whole area of critical thinking and how it can be helpful. Now, critical thinking emerged as a formal discipline. From what I gather, it emerged about 30 years ago, I think, as a formal discipline, and it has continued, and it certainly has grown in scope across the board. More and more people are weighing in on the subject. There are increasingly growing number of books out there that you can buy that have been published and remain in press. I think the last count that I made is there were 65 listed on Amazon alone. And so it is important. Now, has it gone mainstream in the formal educational process that we have in place as a nation? And I would say that it is beginning. It's in the very beginning stages. I remember recently I was doing a major book signing event at at the largest bookstore in Idaho. It was in the Grand Teton Mall. And I was talking to this middle-aged gal who happened to be a teacher. She was a high school teacher. And we were talking about critical thinking, and she was trying to bring together a formal or start a formal initiative on teaching such a course or embedding such concepts within the curriculum at large. And I realized that there is a growing trend across this nation, and also a growing trend across Europe as well. And I was over there recently. And I can tell you that, yes, it's an area of growing interest. So, and it's a little bit of a little bit of a challenge for us when we encounter a growing situation or we encounter serious socio-political and socio-economic situations that have happened one right after the other, like what's happening now, the coronavirus pandemic, quickly followed by the tragic death of George Floyd in Minneapolis. And yeah, we get caught up in the moment, for sure. And I'm not saying that that's all that especially bad, but I think it is important for all of us to recognize that maybe we are caught up in the moment and maybe we need to step back and take a look at the big picture. What exactly is going on? This is nothing new. This has been going on for quite some time. It's just another chapter in a long litany. So what's exactly going on? All right, so I'm going to read two pieces. One is a recent opinion piece by Daniel Hettinger, and it's found in the Wall Street Journal. The title of this piece, and by the way, a number of people out there on the radio and video have mentioned this piece, have discussed it, have addressed it, and have referenced it. So I'm not the only one, but I think it's a good way to begin this show, and it's a good way to kind of check our thinking and to begin to look at it from a historical perspective. Now, I've got two pieces. I've got this one and another one, which I think are particularly good. But I'm going to start with this, and it's by, like I said, it's by Daniel Hettinger. He starts off by saying, this is not 1968. It's worse. The late 1960s were the heyday of modern American liberalism, which was then an ideology of hope. A bipartisan Congress passed landmark civil rights legislation in 1964 and 1965. The participating events of the urban riots in 1968 was the assassination of Martin Luther King Jr., New York, Trenton, Chicago, Detroit, Baltimore, Kansas City, and Washington were on fire. Arguably, back then, despite passage of President Lyndon Johnson's Great Society programs, not enough time had passed for liberal policies to ameliorate conditions in the inner cities. Last week, George Floyd died after rough treatment from arresting Minneapolis policeman Derek Chauvin, who was arrested and charged with murder. Since then, there have been daily protests accompanied by riot and pillage in multiple U.S. cities. A primary claim made repeatedly this week is that the U.S., which means the American people, are guilty of perpetual systemic racism. It is evident from the coverage that most of the demonstrators were born after 1990. By then, the Great Society programs had been in place for 25 years, and now it is 55 years. Annual budget appropriations totaling multiple trillions of dollars on Medicaid, food stamps, welfare, public housing, rent subsidies, and federal aid to public schools have produced what? Since the 1960s, essentially little has changed in the neighborhoods at the center of those long ago urban riots. By current telling, they are about as poor, as crime-ridden, as undereducated, and in poor health as they were when LBJ said he would change them. That means five decades of stasis and stagnation in America's most marginalized places, virtually all of it under Democratic, now progressive, political control. The failure of the liberal model is by now so embarrassing that the current owners of that model have created an alternative universe of explanations, such as blaming it on American settlers in the early 17th century or the non-existence of justice. It must be working because the marchers in Paris and Berlin, of all places, are lecturing the U.S. on systemic racism. Thanks for the memories. This is worse than 1968, he says, because the political system is now engaged in a systemic act of forgetting. Let's forget that this policy failure has happened or why. Let's forget, for instance, that the people living in New York's public housing are overrun with rats, unlit hallways, and no heat in the winter. Let's forget that many blacks have indeed been left behind by a well-documented migration since 1990 of black Americans out of northern cities and Los Angeles into the South, where they have gone in search of economic opportunity. Let's forget, despite a massive massive per annum outlay on Medicaid, some $593 billion in 2018, that Black Americans still have a higher incidence of chronic disease. Simply performing a cut and paste on 50 years of U.S. policy history is an act of nihilism. Pummeled by activists and the media with constant accusations of systemic racism, as this week, and despite what many thought were 50 years of good faith efforts on racial conciliation, people go numb, concluding that the solution being offered now is literally no solution. He goes on to say, this new progressive nihilism says the answer to inner city crime is decriminalization. Because of New York's new bail reform law, most of the looters arrested are being released, even as murderers and burglars are increasing in the city's poorest neighborhoods before these events. The new nihilism minimizes this week's ideologically driven assaults on private property because it is replaceable, quote unquote. In fact, it is well established that many of the 1968 burned down neighborhoods have struggled to revive ever since. He goes on to say that the new nihilism says no matter how many reform police commissioners are appointed or Black mayors elected, nothing has changed. That is the definition of hopelessness. But he says that it's not hopeless. One could, for example, give people a better chance at home ownership and home equity, as HUD Secretary Ben Carson has proposed, through reforms of the mortgage lending market and reducing regulatory hurdles to urban housing construction. Get rid of those god-awful public housing prisons. But no, the public housing authorities are patronage mills, so it can't happen. Black parents, he says, love charter schools and voucher support private schools because they teach values, self-respect, and hope. But no, this option for poor and lower income parents has more Democratic Party opposition than ever. When will we see white college students marching in the streets over this moral abomination? Never. One could argue, he says, that the job creation and rising income of recent years for young Black Americans are more in step with the U.S.'s 244-year history of opportunity. But why bother? The nihilism of permanent guilt is easier because it substitutes sentiment for substance and absolves anyone of responsibility for past public policy errors. It remains to be learned how the American people of any race are processing the events of the past week. Media minimalism says the choices between Joe Biden and Donald Trump, it's a lot bigger than that. Okay, so that is the rather interesting article by Daniel Hettinger of the Wall Street Journal. And by the way, he's written other rather impressive pieces as well in the past. You see, the closing of his argument was maybe there's a better way to think about this than what is being offered to us. And, you know, that's, I guess that's one of my, you know, major themes, one of my pet peeves, if you will, is there are certain things that are being offered to us to consider, but are they the right things? Do they represent the complete picture? Do they represent something that has long-term positive effects? Or are they being presented to us because they support some ill-defined hidden agenda? And I would say that that's what's going on here. I'm not proposing that I have all of the answers. I am proposing something quite emphatically, which is to ask ourselves, how should we think about this? How should we think about what is going on currently? And what has happened in the past? How have we dealt with those things in the past like this? Have they been effective? What can we learn from history? What can we learn from current events? And what exactly is the big picture here? What exactly is the big picture? Is the big picture racism? Is the big picture what the Black Lives Matter movement wants you to believe? Or is the big picture something else? And often we encounter these situations, particularly those people who are experienced in the area of critical thinking and complex problem solving. Often we encounter situations where we can uncover the hidden agenda quite quickly and be able to expose the fraud. And so that's what I think that's one of our biggest challenges here is to do that. We have to press on with another. This audio clip coming up is rather important about George Friedman's latest book, The Storm Before the Calm. I think it's exceptionally important that we consider what he has to say about this particular situation to shed some more light on it. He's, I think, one of our greatest strategic thinkers currently living in and working in America. So let me get this audio clip up of George Foreman. Oh, and I noticed that I misspoke. It's George Friedman. George Friedman's book. The book is The Storm Before the Calm. It's a new book, just been released. And I apologize for that. Apologize to you and apologize to George. George Friedman, a rather impressive individual. He was the founder of Stratfor, by the way. And I have been a paying member of that organization for some time, because I utilize their strategic analysis and consider it on a regular basis. Very, very good, by the way. So here goes. This is a commentary. It's about 7 minutes long. It's a commentary on a portion of George Friedman's new book. And it's appropriate for us to consider what he has to say, how he views this situation from his perspective. And he has a global and a great historical perspective as well. He's very much like Victor Davis Hanson in terms of his historical perspective. And you know, I think it's very valuable. It's valuable to me. And I think it would be valuable to most anybody, certainly anyone listening to this radio show or podcast. So here goes.
The Beginning of the Cyclic Shift by George Friedman, June 4th, 2020. A number of people have asked me if the events this week are what I was predicting in my book, The Storm Before the Calm. They asked because they thought my predictions were arriving too early. This is very much the kind of thing I was expecting and about the time I was expecting it to start, but we are not even close to the end. I wrote that this will be a decade of social, economic, and international instability. Not all crises will be this intense. Many, particularly the economic crises, will be less intense, but will last longer. To get a sense of where we stand, think of the late 1960s and early 1970s. In 1968, Martin Luther King was murdered, and riots broke out across the country with the police and National Guard using force to control the rioters. In summer 1968, at the Democratic National Convention in Chicago, thousands of anti-war protesters showed up against the Democratic Party, which they saw as the party of imperialist wars and domestic oppression. Richard Nixon was elected that year, and in 1971, facing what was really minor inflation compared to what came later, he imposed wage and price controls and impulsively went off the gold standard. He later resigned to avoid being impeached. There was then a period of relatively peace under Gerald Ford, who took over from Nixon in 1974. During this time, there was also a massive economic crisis with high inflation, soaring interest rates, and unemployment nearing 10%. This was driven by the Arab oil embargo, triggered by a war with Israel, which left Americans standing on long lines only to find the gas stations out of gasoline. Jimmy Carter was elected president and tried to take the country back to the model that Franklin Roosevelt created. It failed, and he delivered a famous speech about the country's malaise. Then the Iranian Revolution and kidnapping of diplomats came, ending in a disastrous hostage rescue attempt. The Roosevelt era was exhausted. Ronald Reagan was elected and created a radically new structure that led to a cycle of prosperity. And now the Reagan cycle is coming to an end. And just as the Roosevelt cycle culminated in a bit more than a decade of dysfunction and even despair, so too we are now entering that phase. The coronavirus sort of signaled that, although it had nothing to do with the failing system. But this week's events, which resemble similar events since the 1960s, are more of a systemic announcement of the beginning of the transition. Just as the last decade of the Roosevelt cycle had near its beginning a racial event, the end of the Reagan cycle is being signaled by the death of George Floyd, with consequences similar to those after Martin Luther King was killed. There is an intimate relationship between race and the American economy that goes back to the founding. As I said in my book, the original American sin was not slavery. Americans were not unique in holding slaves. Rather, it was a betrayal of its own principles, where Jefferson had written, "We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal." The South was a plantation society dependent on cheap labor. It needed slaves to function. It also needed power against a growing North that had slaves but was not dependent on them and had a nascent abolitionist movement. The South rejected the idea of freeing the slaves, but it demanded that the slaves be counted in the census so that the South's representation in Congress would be as large as possible. The North objected, and there could be no republic without a compromise. The compromise was that slaves counted as three-fifths of a person. The founders believed deeply in the equality of men, but they could not form a republic if blacks were seen as equal. So in the act of designating them three-fifths of a person, they symbolically declared them less than human. In this way, they preserved the principle of universal equality, but did so by designating a class of humans as subhuman. The Hayes era grew out of the Civil War, which was about the status of blacks. The Roosevelt era was forged out of an alliance of Southern segregationists and Northern blacks. One of the central features of the era that spanned from Roosevelt to Carter was the civil rights movement and the attack on segregation. The Reagan era struggled with the issue as well, with heated debates over affirmative action and other measures. The issue of race has torn the country apart many times, and many explanations can be offered as to why. It's a personal issue for all of us. I went to a predominantly black high school. It was a frightening experience. High school boys emerge as men through testing themselves physically. In the suburbs, football was the key. Jackson High had no football team. The tests were found in fighting and violence, and I was forced to face black teenagers who were bigger and tougher than me. I learned to fear them. They were doing nothing but what was normal for 16-year-olds, but they posed what seemed at the time an existential challenge to me. It took years for me to move beyond my high school experience and to realize the kids I went to school with were just kids like any others. They saw me in the perpetual sin that was perpetuated against them. Did I ever learn to lose the fear? I think so. Yet does anyone really lose the fear that dominated him when he was young? Each day is combat for boys, and that combat shapes them. That is my story. Each one of us experiences the tension of race, and each emerges from it differently. Whenever a cycle fails and things that were certain suddenly become mysteries, one of the first things that emerges is the deeply rooted tension between black and white. It is a tension that is always there. The history is long and deep and filled with fear. When things become uncertain, the thing that suddenly shows itself is the fear between the races and the attempt on all sides to use that fear to their advantage. It is as if the Israelites were freed but continued to live in Egypt. I felt myself at war with blacks and losing. A teenage boy can't imagine the degree to which blacks felt they were losing. And the truth is that, for the most part, they were losing. They knew that. And the fights we had were built with that knowledge. When they see one of their own slowly strangled to death, they feel rage, but also, as I know in retrospect, helplessness and despair. This is the original sin of our republic, and none of us know how to solve it, least of all the enlightened whites who side with them. African Americans know that there was no more enlightened white man than Thomas Jefferson, and by all accounts, the love of his life and the mother of six of his children was a black woman, Sally Hemings. He freed her and their children in his will, but he did not free his other slaves. The problem is that we are not monsters, white or black. We are humans, and we are filled with fear, hope, and a breathtaking inability to understand the complex realities that come from being human. And we love to feel superior to those who are different and those who disagree with us. So to the question of whether I expected this, the answer is yes. And much of what I say here is scattered throughout my book. But this is not the end. Race is always there, and frequently the breakout of race-related protests and violence is just the beginning of things. But it is never the end of things because the original sin haunts us, and goodwill and wishes are just words. So we begin the crisis of the 2020s, the decade of transformation, as we began other transformations with the matter of race.
Okay, that was George Friedman and talking a commentary about some of the things in his book. And I'm not here to subscribe to all of his ideas or predictions. I do think it is a good thing for us to consider, along with other things as well. I do think that we have, as Daniel Hettinger pointed out in the article that I just read, we have been struggling with this whole issue for quite some time, and we need to have develop a sober insight and have a meaningful adult discussion going forward in terms of how should we deal with this? How should we establish our value system that can support all of us in a meaningful, productive, and basically a proper way based upon the American values? That's what, you know, and you can say, well, that's kind of like Pollyanna thinking, Kevin. You know, it's this or that or whatever. And I would say that our first order of business is to calm our thinking down to the point where it's not hysterical, but it is thoughtful, and we can establish some kind of productive pathway going forward. Okay. I think I've got time for this. Now, this is another piece. This is another viewpoint, if you will. And I think the reason I'm going to refer to it and read it and make some comments on it was because I do think it is important for us to consider people that have something meaningful to say, a thoughtful commentary on what's going on to help us or to help frame our model of reality and put it in some kind of a meaningful perspective. Okay. This is, a weekend interview with Gary Saul Morrison. It's in the opinion page of the Wall Street Journal. The title of this interview is Violent Protest and the Intelligentsia. Let me begin. He says the similarities between this week's riots and the Los Angeles riots of 1992 are obvious. Both were occasioned by appalling video images, and both divided the nation along partisan and ideological lines. The difference between the two events, however, are more revealing. The violence in 1992 came after a court verdict. The beating and arrest of Rodney King had happened more than a year before. This year's riots came within days of George Floyd's killing by Minneapolis officers. The riots of 1992 were mostly confined to poor and working class areas of Los Angeles. This week saw mayhem all over America and in Los Angeles, New York, and elsewhere. The rioters targeted wealthy streets and neighborhoods. But perhaps the most striking difference is the rationalization and sometimes full-throated defense of violence from left-wing elites, the glorification of havoc, the vilification of cops and their middle-class admirers, highfalutin defense of vandalism, the sense of revolution and class warfare was everywhere this week. The underclass arrayed against the petty bourgeoisie shop owners, the elites, and those they claim to represent against everybody else. Now, this interviewer says that he's interviewing Gary Saul Morrison. So this interviewer says that Gary Saul Morrison says he has no special insight regarding police actions and the death of George Floyd, but he does have a provocative thesis about America's current political moment. To me, he says, it's astonishing like late 19th century, early 20th century Russia, when basically the entire educated class felt you simply had to be against the regime or some sort of revolutionary. Mr. Morrison, age 72, is a professor of Russian literature at Northwestern University and an accomplished interpreter of Fyodor Dostoevsky's Anton Chekhov's and Leo Tolstoy's books. Obviously, we haven't arrived at anything like what Lenin called a revolutionary situation, Mr. Morrison says, but we have arrived at a situation in which well-intended liberal people often can't bring themselves to say that lawless violence is wrong. The late Tsarist Russia, some political parties and other groups, the Social Democrats, the anarchists, the Marxists, explicitly endorse terrorism. The Liberal Party, the Constitutional Democrats, they call themselves, did not condone terrorism, Mr. Morrison says, but they refused to condemn it. And indeed, they called for the release from prison of all terrorists who were pledged to continue terrorism right away. A famous line from one of the liberal leaders put it this way: condemn terrorism? That would be the moral death of the party. Continuing, the lesson seems highly relevant today. When you've dragged along into something, when you're dragged along into something you don't really believe yourself because otherwise you are identified with those evil people and your primary identity is being a good guy, not like those people, you will wind up supporting things you know to be wrong. And unless there is some moral force that will stop it, the slide will accelerate. Mr. Morrison, ensconced in his delightfully untidy book-laden office in Chicago, as we chat on Zoom, concedes that a scholar who spends much of his time thinking and writing about Russia's revolutionary period will tend to look for parallels between the time and our own. The parallels don't obtain in every way, but some of them make the analogy worth considering. One is that many of today's revolutionaries are wildly successful and privileged. Take Colin Ford Mattis and Urrutia Raman, both New York lawyers in their 30s who have been criminally charged for attempting to firebomb a police vehicle with a Molotov cocktail. Mr. Mattis was educated at Princeton and New York University, Mr. Ratham at Fordham. Why do people at the top want to destroy the system that enabled them to get there? No, Mr. Morrison says, you have it wrong. When you're such a person, you don't feel you're at the top. The people at the top are wealthy business people, and you're an intellectual. You think that people of ideas should be at the top. The word intelligentsia, he notes, come from Russia. In the classic period from about 1860 to the first Russian Revolution in 1905, the word did not mean everybody who was educated. It meant educated people who identified with one or another of the radical movements. Intelligence believed in atheism, revolution in either socialism or anarchism. He says that the idea was that since they knew the theory, they were morally superior and they should be in charge, and that there was something fundamentally wrong with the world when practical people were in charge. So what you take from your education would be the ideology that would justify this kind of activity. Justify it because the wrong people have the power and you should have it. You don't feel like you're the establishment. Continuing. Is American society shaped by Protestant Christianity and dominated by a kind of dovish humanitarianism, left liberalism, ever likely to fall into the barbarity of the Russian Revolution? That's a question. Aren't we too, I fumble for a word as I formulated the question, soft for that sort of totalitizing violence? I don't know, Mr. Morrison answered after a long pause. I don't know if that means people won't go as far as they did in Russia or if it just means there will be less resistance to it. The danger begins, he thinks, when complex social and political problems can't be debated any longer. You get into a revolutionary situation because people can't hear, he says. Can't there be a dialogue on important questions, or is there only one thing to say about every question? In other words, I would say parenthetically, they're not willing or able to use critical thinking. Well, continuing, he says, well, yes, but it's not quite as simple as that. When you can't do that, you're heading to a one-party state or a dictatorship of some sort. If one party is always wrong and the other always right, why not just have the right one? Mr. Morrison speaks with conviction about the peril of ideological segregation. It was very easy for white people to believe evil things of black people when they never met any. But when you live with somebody, you realize that they're no worse than you are. We've increasingly had ideological segregation on both sides. Each side has caricature views of the other. The assumption of historical inevitability may play a part here. You hear it in our political language. A favorite policy is an idea whose time has come. A dissatisfavored one is on the wrong side of history. This sort of teleological thinking, history has a direction and that direction is identical with our political views, is fervently, if unconsciously, embraced by highly educated people today. It was also one of the central arguments of late 19th century Russian thought, Mr. Morrison says. Does history have a direction and is later necessarily better? The greatest thinkers, Tolstoy, Alexander Herzen, answered no, later is not always better. They believed that some sort of thinking was an importation of religious provincialism into history. The determinism of Hegel and Marx, the difficulty of this form of thinking is that it paralyzes you from acting. Between the wars, it was common for people to say, yes, you may like liberal democracy, but that's of the past. We fascists are of the future, or we communists are of the future. People would resign themselves to the inevitable and conclude, well, I can't fight the future. I can't resist the fascists or the communists. I suggest that the American left is very fond of this teleological language. Barack Obama spoke in his first inaugural address of the worn-out dogmas that for far too long have strangled our politics. But Mr. Morrison reminds me that Ronald Reagan used similar rhetoric. Part of being a revolutionary is knowing that you don't have to acquiesce to the tired old ideas of the past, he said in a 1985 speech. Another marker of the Russian intelligentsia was the sheer contempt its members had for the peasants and the workers they claimed to represent. How many workers, how many peasants were even in the Bolshevik Party? Very few. Lenin's whole idea was that the working class, left to itself, would never develop more than a trade union consciousness. That's his famous phrase. They had to be led by the intelligentsia and completely disciplined. No matter what you say, they will do it, no matter how violent. They don't have to understand the reasons. They just do it because they're the agents of history, as Marx described them, that implies a contempt for the working class and a greater contempt for the peasantry. The supposition that America is moving toward anarchy or revolution because we've had a week of riots or 3 years of bad faith and acrimony or 3 decades of polarization still seems hard to accept. Mr. Morrison is careful not to predict the course of events. He uses the phrase, insofar as the Russian example applies, more than once. But, he says, we have a major depression, we have terrible fear from the illness, and now we have mass riots in the streets, which our leaders do not seem to know how to handle. That's a very rapid slide from only a year ago, and there's no reason to think it will slow down. The slide could well continue. And history can unfold in unpredictable ways. Who would have guessed 20 years ago, he asked, that the First Amendment freedom guarantee would become passé on the liberal left? I used to get a laugh from my students by quoting a Soviet citizen I talked to once. He said to me, "Of course we have freedom of speech. We just don't allow people to lie." That used to get a laugh. They don't laugh anymore. Okay, so that completes this article on the interview with Gary Saul Morrison. And the interviewer was Barton Swain in the opinion piece of the Wall Street Journal. And again, in summary, this scholar sees disturbing parallels between Russia before the revolution and contemporary America. Now, so how is this going to play out? That's a very good question. And we will conclude our show with that thought in mind. And now some thoughts from Laura Ingram on this subject.
Remember at the beginning of the lockdown when I warned you about how the Democrats and their allies in the media and medicine even would try to use the excuse of the pandemic to keep the economy closed as long as possible and then foist a new normal on us?
As a society, just forget about shaking hands. We don't need to shake hands.
Everything that comes into the house, I wipe it down. Packages, mail, on everything.
Voting by mail is just an opportunity to make it easier for folks out there.
Will we return to normal? I don't think we return to normal.
Oh, come on. After the past 14 days, that's basically all out the window. Over the weekend in L.A. and Philadelphia, we had huge crowds. Before that, widespread riots, and we had widespread looting. So much for social distancing. But meanwhile, millions of Americans are still living in Democrat states like California, Virginia, Illinois, Michigan. They're still standing on those stupid red dots outside the hardware store. Don't you love those? Are the arrows of the grocery store? It's ridiculous. And the left, seeing how compliant so many Americans have been, is now on to the new normal. Okay, so under this new normal, You have no right to an opinion that conflicts with or calls into question any aspect of their campaign to destabilize America through bullying and violence. Just ask the editor of the Philadelphia Inquirer, who was fired for the sin of this headline, "Buildings Matter Too." Well, at least he only lost his job. When you physically defend your business or home, you could end up like David Dorn, left to die on the ground. He was allegedly murdered by this man. There are no televised memorials planned for Captain Dorn, at least that I know of. Now, in this new normal, if you lose your business to looting or fire, well, you're supposed to empathize with those who carried it out. Because if you do, that demonstrates a higher recognition of your privilege. And in this new normal, it's perfectly acceptable to assume the worst motives on the part of anyone who doesn't repeat the progressive mantra du jour.
Morning, a friend of mine, you know, posted something without posting anything about hashtag Black Lives Matter.
We should be so disturbed in the way that we are that you can't help yourself but speak out.
White silence is incredibly powerful. It's not neutral. It acts like a weapon. It's not even silent. Like, it speaks volumes, right?
So you get it. You'll be forced to repeat after them or else. And inspired by Al Sharpton's long history of shaking down corporate America, they're now demanding that businesses write fat checks or risk being branded insensitive at best, racist at worst. And without even knowing how the money will be spent, fearful wealthy elites are falling all over themselves to appear the most woke.
The events of the past week have created a sense of true urgency that has arisen across our nation, particularly in view of the racial injustices that we have seen in the communities where we work and live. We all need to do more. Again, those are comments from Brian Moynihan, the chairman and CEO at Bank of America, on this new commitment that they're announcing, $1 billion additional over the next 4 years.
Well, J.P. Morgan CEO Jamie Dimon even went to a local branch to take a knee in solidarity. But will the money really buy them protection? I guess until the next round of demands, which of course is any minute now, well, we'll find out. But the subjugation and self-humiliation that we've seen over the past week is truly nauseating. If you thought the performance activism of white liberals dramatically dropping to their knees, fists in the air, wasn't bad enough, well, you obviously missed the new trend. Foot-washing stations for activists. And yes, they're manned by liberals with almost a religious zeal. And don't think of having a D next to your name, even if you're a far left Democrat. Don't think that's enough to save you in this new normal. The pajama boy mayor of Minneapolis found that some of his new friends in the riot and protest business weren't so friendly after all.
Okay, and then he answered no in terms of defunding the police department, and he was jeered out of the crowd. All right, so that completes our show for this week. Not particularly good news. We're trying to deal with it as best we can. Have a great week, and we'll see you all next time. Well, that went fast. So this is a close of another show, another Throttle Up. And before I go, I would like to acknowledge a few people. I'd like to thank my listening audience for being here. And I would like to thank Red State Talk Radio for providing us an opportunity for each and every weekend to put on this radio show that we call Throttle Up. And I would like to thank all of you veterans out there. Thank you for your service. And I would like to thank the families of the veterans. Thank you for supporting this noble cause. And I would like to thank all of you on active duty in the Guard and the Reserve. Thank you for serving this great country of ours. And with that, I would like to say goodbye, and we will see you all again next week.